Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred, we have an interesting topic for today.
Well, yeah, we just ran through like three or four of them, so you don't know which one I'm going to talk about, do you? Let me get you started here.
That's why I was trying to segue back to you seamlessly without our listeners knowing, but you've blown my cover.
Yeah, that happens. Sorry about that. Well, it's a good segue, though, is how do you know what you need to know? I could have, before we hit record, we could have done a prompt and said, oh, we're going to talk about this topic. That's one of the purposes of a body of knowledge, and that's what I do want to talk about. So I know that you're working on, and I've been slow in reviewing and getting back to you, a reliability engineering or reliability body of knowledge. And I think most of our listeners are aware that there are bodies of knowledge there's SMRP, I think I'm got the acronyms right. Society of Maintenance Reliability Professionals has a body of knowledge. It has five pillars, I believe. The Association of Maintenance Professionals, which I think they changed their name to something else, has a body of knowledge and includes reliability leadership attributes. You know, take charge, take the initiative. Those kinds of things are in it. Neither of those two bodies of knowledge have much statistics. So people look at the ASQ body of knowledge for reliability engineering, and a huge section of that is reliability stuff or reliability statistics in design of experiments and all kinds of weird, wonderful stuff. And thus getting the moniker of being the most difficult one, the certification to get, because you got to know a lot of stats to pass this, or some stats anyway. But I think over a year ago, we talked about, well, creating our own and what's the purpose of it. And so it might be a good time to reflect on that, because we're about ready to, publish this thing, and we're kind of editing and reviewing it and getting ready to look at it closer and share it. But what's the purpose of a body of knowledge in general? And what are we trying to do with the one that we're creating here?
And we go around the board on this a few times, because we can make a body of knowledge in a way that's very, very much like a glossary or a dictionary. So you hear this random word in your place of work, open the body of knowledge and go to the right page and say, okay, so that's what the CDS stands for example. Another approach to a body of knowledge is to create it with a narrative, a context. So you want to design something reliable. How do you go about it? How do you start, like more like a DIY guide? And there's massive pros and massive cons for each different approach you can possibly think of.
Well, you kind of need to know both, right? If you don't know what a CDF is at all, and you run across it in a narrative, I'm like, well, what's that? And then you need maybe we should publish a glossary separately. Mm-hmm. and it says, well, right, if you link to, here's where the definition of this thing is, and here's where you can find more details about XYZ term. What you're talking about is putting those things into context to why you would even want to look at a CDF.
Yep, and I'd also say there's a whole other bunch of topics which I believe that if you and I had our way, would not be in any body of knowledge, but I'd feel compelled to include them in a body of knowledge I write, at least, because everyone is aware that where these certain terms or ideas exist, and if they don't see them in your body of knowledge, is perception perhaps that your body of knowledge isn't as comprehensive as it should be, and then that runs a risk of just turning into an encyclopedia of everything and just not useful.
Not useful. No, well, I think you're referring to MTBF. We're not going to put that in there. Sorry. And it's in the glossary, and it has a great big red warning sticker over the top of it. Do not use. Avoid at all costs. This is, tainted metric here. But I digress. But the idea is that I think what you're leading to, though, is that the body of knowledge provides a framework or a guideline for a person's career? Would that be safe to say this is what you should master in order to be considered really good at what you do and as a reliability professional? Is that a fair way to look at it?
I'd have to think about that because I think it makes sense. But by the same token, I think it's almost impossible to reach that goal of being exceptionally competent based on what should be a relatively simple body of knowledge. The other part of it's in the application and the practice and the experience and mm-hmm. the learning based on those topics. I mean, there's plenty of, dare I say it, ASQ certified reliability engineers that we've come across who probably are the most high flying reliability engineers. Would that be a fair comment to make?
Well, and I'm way too familiar with the body of knowledge and the certification thing, but the intent is not, well, part of the intent is to raise money for ASQ. But part of it is also to say, well, these are the spread of types of techniques and tools and activities that you need to be aware of at certain levels or masters of at certain levels to be in it. And their criteria is that you've 7 years of experience or some combination of education and work experience. So it's not the 20-year veteran. Of lots of experience. It's early in the career, your first 4 or 5 years in the business, roughly on average. Mm-hmm. People sit for these exams or they make it to it later. But the idea is that it's a milestone of you're aware of the range of tools and activities. I think that's its expressed intent.
So that's different to the intent you described earlier. Yes.
Right. And one of the things I tried to do with ASQ is say, hey, we need a master level one. So for somebody that's at 15 years in their career, what should they know that's different than the entry level folks, mm-hmm. So the early career folks? And their marketing team went off and found that, well, we can't sell enough of those, so we're not going to develop that.
Right.
So whatever. But a body of knowledge doesn't have to be a point in time in somebody's career.
No, it can be increasing measures of excellence or represent increasing measures of excellence or sophisticated. And that also changes from job to job. I mean, mm-hmm. some reliability engineers are 100% reliability engineers. Others are a little bit more part-time, and that's okay because each different company has different requirements. And so the reliability engineer might spend, say, 50% of his or her time doing traditional reliability engineering, and the other 50% is other stuff.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. No, what I'm thinking too is that it's different by industry too. If you're in a, you know, creating rocket ships, you're not going to get 30 rocket ships as samples to go test. You know, full systems. You get it one or two, and you got to make. And there's a lot of work that goes. It's a different approach. It's the same basic questions we're all trying to answer with these different systems. But if I'm making a throwaway 10-cent widget, I can get a gazillion of them to evaluate and test. Well, I actually did once. I got zip ties. They were a fraction of a cent each, and they gave me thousands of them to test. And I ran into the constraint of I only had one Instron machine to evaluate their strength. And so they had a bottleneck. There's always constraints. In some areas that you're more a maintenance focus, we're doing availability and maintainability is primary what I'm working on, and reliability is a subset of it. In other places, it's all reliability and there's no maintenance on this thing. It's not repairable. So yet I think simply being aware, simply being aware that a part of our field includes maintainability, even though I'm working on a system that is inherently just a reliability system, it's not repairable. There may become a change in the format or a change in the platform or change in the customer's expectations that, like the legislation that's being proposed around the world is to the right for repairability.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're not even aware that there are maintenance tools and practices and approaches, I think you're at a disservice for your own professional development. And so that as the condition, you have to be aware that those things are available to know when they apply. And I think that's one of the purposes of a body of knowledge. What's the span of what we should be aware of so that when we have the opportunity to use that activity or that knowledge, we can. I think it gives us that breadth of exposure that I don't think other documents provide.
And you can run the risk of, as was the case for the rocket industry or the spacecraft industry you talked about earlier, there are plenty of body of knowledge type documents out there which simply devolve into these monstrous checklists of activities.
Mm-hmm.
And it really destroys any appetite for critical thinking and first principles deduction and all that wonderful stuff you need to have to make stuff reliable.
So
that's the other risk you run too, the body of knowledge, where it becomes a list of tools, as you say, but then those tools get confused with the confused as being a strategy, which is not the case.
Right. No, I totally agree. I'm thinking of 780 mil standard or mil spec or whatever, 785, which Carl describes that at one time he saw, and I've seen variations of this, where they take the cover off of this document and they put their company cover letter over the top and say, here's our plan. We'll just do all of this. And, you know, it's well, you don't, even in the document itself, there's a quote, or line that says you need to select the tools that are appropriate for your particular circumstance. You don't just do all this stuff. That's not reliability. Mm-hmm. Many people gloss over that, going, oh, it lists 318 things. Let me figure out how many samples I need. And they're off and running. And I was like, I agree with you. Part of that's difficult to write into a body of knowledge, though, is that, by the way, you need to think. That's skill number one. You need to think.
It's a challenging topic to put into a body of knowledge, especially when body of knowledge tend to be testable. A lot of money is generated from people passing tests like ASQ, run tests where you pass an exam based on your understanding of the body of knowledge. We mentioned Carl, our friend Carl, who does a lot of Famiers and Famikas and stuff. You and I both done plenty of Famiers as well, but we know that you can do a Famier or a Famika by the book. The book doesn't tell you how many people you need to have conducting a Famier. The book doesn't tell you how to control the group discussion. The book doesn't tell you how far down is far enough for a root cause. The book doesn't really tell you to prioritize.
Careful, though. Carl's book does cover a lot of that stuff.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah,
Carl's
book does, but the standard doesn't.
That's what I should have said, the standard. What a Famier is. I mean, a Famier can still be classified as a Famier when it's been done poorly.
Yes.
A body of knowledge, that's what I was sort of referring to when I say by the book, because you're 100% right. Carl's written a book on how to conduct for me as well, which is why I dropped his name.
That's right. And it was the book, capital T, you know.
Yeah. But the human side of running or facilitating a worthwhile for me is very difficult to capture, even harder to test against for a body of knowledge. And that's one of the ongoing struggles. We can teach statistics out the wazoo, and there's plenty of statistical things you can do. But if you are one third of the way into your developmental program, there's no point in trying to characterize to nine decimal places the shape parameter of your final product.
Right.
All you want to know is, does it wear in, wear out, have a constant hazard rate to go and inform where you're going to next look for to improve reliability.
Right.
And those nuances are easily lost in a body of knowledge.
Well, that's why I like the draft I've seen from you. Is it has more of a narrative. It becomes a book if you add all of the considerations and nuances and stuff. Now, one of the things I've been struggling with is, and Carl and I are working on a book. Hopefully it becomes the book at some time. We realize that we're talking about all of these activities. The book is about how do you create a reliability plan? And there's a number of steps that we outline and go through and we work through. And at one point we said exactly what you're alluding to, Chris, is that if FMEA is the right tool to do, it's not a checklist. It's one concept is what we do is integrated with the rest of the team and the program. It's not, you don't outsource it, for example, and let somebody else do it and then send you the result, which is meaningless at that point. But it serves a purpose. It adds value. It does all these other cool things. And then we realized that writing a great report or doing a halt test and taking great pictures and doing failure analysis are all for naught unless you can actually communicate it well and that it actually adds value. So clear writing, crisp presentations, succinct recommendations, being able to understand what are the key things that need to be done. Those are all soft skills, which most engineers just don't get in school. We get to learn how to do soldering, and software design and use these fancy CAD tools, but we don't learn how to talk to other people and interact and create relationships and build trust, and all those things are as important as knowing what a CDF is. I'd say more important, but
I'd say a lot more important. And we can always sometimes get engineers or managers can be inappropriately impressed by reliability engineers who seem to know all those three-letter acronyms and all those statistical concepts and use sigma and standard deviation this and Weibull that and Weibull plot and all these wonderful things. But that is not of itself a really good metric for understanding how good a reliability engineer that person was. Okay, another example that springs to mind is I remember sitting at a conference, the RAMS conference actually, or symposium, I should say, and I was watching a senior reliability engineer talk about this Weibull plot, and he was quite excited about it. And he was going through, I think it was about, let's say, 40 or 50 points on this Weibull plot. Mm-hmm. And he was getting very excited because he was able to identify, at least in his mind, a bunch of little individual failure mechanisms, and he put circles around them on the whiteboard. And it was simply a number of three or four data points in a row, which seemed to create a little mini line in this Weibull plot. And you and I both know
there's this thing called you use it all the time in your webinars, the random hand of chance, or what is it?
Random
hand of failure. Yeah. Yeah. Beware what you read into the tea leaves.
Right. It's just, you don't get that understanding without experience. And then what a lot of professors, a lot of teachers don't do is say, let's take a Weibull plot. Let's get a computer to generate Weibull data points, and let's look at how smooth these so-called perfect Weibull random variables are.
Yeah.
And that's something, again, you can't easily encode in a body of knowledge. And I'm listening to this pork chop up on stage, being as excited as he was, like he discovered a cure for cancer. But there are a couple of us who are going, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, but he is a senior reliability engineer, Fred.
Yeah.
With all the certifications you could hope to have.
Well, if he would have used that and said, I've got this deflection here, we're not sure if that's random or not. So we went and did some failure analysis on these points and these points, and they're inherently different. There's evidence that this was the plot itself provides you a clue, but you need to actually do the failure analysis to see if the failure mechanisms are different or not. You can't just read it in, there's 4 points here. That must be different than that's in this. And that one looks like a infant mortality. We're going to go yell at the operators, blah, blah, blah. What? Come on. What's the next step here? This is not conclusive. You got 50 points. You don't know much. You're reading four and taking action on it? No.
50 points is something that a lot of reliability engineers can only dream about in terms of data. So.
Yeah, that's true. But the idea is well taken. It's the body of knowledge is not going to substitute for experience in nuances and stuff. Yet I think it's worth putting in it. You know, one of the criteria, and it frustrated the daylights out of me when I was on a committee with ASQ looking at updating the body of knowledge. This is years ago. And we made some recommendations similar to what we're talking about. And the moderator, who's not a reliability engineer, says, well, those are not testable, so we can't include those.
There you go. Yeah,
no, those are important. They have to be included. Well, important is not testable, so we're not going to put it in there. Like, okay, this doesn't make much sense. So one of the things, the idea of creating a body of knowledge, I think, is not to make money. I think we could, it to me, the primary purpose, and this is a summary of all of what we've been talking about, is to help people improve their game, you know, be aware of the interconnectedness and the different types of things are available. It's an awareness approach, but it's also, there's more to it than just a glossary of terms. And I think that's where it comes out in your narrative to some extent. And it certainly needs a book written behind it. So there's your next project there, Chris, just in case you have something, need something to do for this weekend.
Right. Listen, we'll talk about salary and working conditions after this podcast.
Yeah. Well, you have a book. You have a massive book that goes into great detail about a bunch of this stuff.
I know. And that's written for a certain audience. And right. It's not the audience that it is a high level postgraduate audience. And I mean that in a very literal term. It was a book written to support some of the reliability engineering postgraduate courses I teach. Mm-hmm. Even since I've written that book, which wasn't that long ago, I know there's lots of stuff I want to add or improve or change or modify, which is the way of all things. But I still wouldn't classify that as a body of knowledge. That's a textbook.
Oh, no, I agree. But I think that behind a body of knowledge, there can be a book that allows you the medium to go into, this is where you really need to think this through. This is, you need to challenge assumptions. You need to do this. And that came across more in your, just because it's written for a postgraduate audience doesn't mean that it's not what reliability engineers need to strive towards and have the nuances to get there.
That was the intent. But I'll go back to a point where you said the body of knowledge is not there to make money. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with us or anybody else writing a body of knowledge for the purpose of making money through selling the book, but not through testing, not through some second, more nefarious mechanism making money.
No, I think it's the books and courses of how to implement it, how to master the content that's in there. I think that's fine. And I think that part of it is that awareness part. Oh, I need to know what a CDF is. What's a CDF? Oh, there happens to be a course over here or a webinar. I think your webinar in an hour that talks about CDFs. I think you titled it CDF. What is that? Or something like that.
It's been a little while. I think it's the PDF, CDFs, and other. I don't know. So I should know this. It was my webinar.
Yeah. But we could link to it and say, all right, if you really need to get a good intro to this, here's a good piece of content. And it's free. Just go check it out. But if you want to master the use of those things, well, then, you know, it's either coaching or it's get engaged with us and ask some questions, you know, like send us questions here for the podcast. And that's a way for you to be aware what questions to ask. When I hope that part of the purpose of the body of knowledge is to create that. Well, what is this? How do I use this? Those are good questions. And the second part is to say, this is the implementing it well does it has this value. And I think that's where books and courses and coaching and stuff like that come into play to be a master at that. Now, I don't think learning is to get a certificate. Learning is to master the content so you can apply it well. And that's where I think is the dividing line between selling an exam and ongoing education versus helping people master the content, master the field, master the application of what this stuff is. And so I separate it that way.
Mm-hmm. It's, I also do think we need to include those terms, which we don't like, but we need to include those terms with an explanation as to why those terms shouldn't be included in the body of knowledge.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think it's more for the glossary. And if you're going to do metrics, you're going to hear about all kinds of stuff, but it's also, if it's a guidepost for the industry, then I think it's worth, and that's something we didn't talk about, but probably worth another episode, is the body of knowledge a reflection of what people do, or is it a reflection of what they should do? And I think there is this real separation.
I think it has to be both, because people are not going to all of a sudden stop getting MTBF numbers on specification sheets from vendors.
Yeah.
And if you have a body of knowledge which doesn't really address the MTBF at all, what is that poor young reliability engineer going to do?
Yeah, they're going to open up a different book that has it and then drive off and do chi-squared testing.
Right. So I think that you need to have MTBF's a great example. I think you need to have a topic, a section dedicated to the MTBF saying this is what it means. And this is what reliability is, and they're not the same. And if you here are some examples where if you think you can use the MTBF, it can go very bad, like this. That's useful. It's not necessarily what people should be doing, but the reality is you're going to get fit rates.
Fit rates and NTTFs and MTBFs. Yeah. Oh, I agree. So anyway, the idea is, many faceted, but I think the existing body of knowledge that's out there for the industry aren't forward-looking enough. And I think what you're putting together is, it's in a different style than a annotated glossary, essentially. So I think it has a lot more value in that regard. And I know we've got another round or two of reviews and comments on it, but hopefully we'll get it out here pretty soon and get some more people to take a look at it for us.
Absolutely.
There we go. Now we have a deadline. This podcast is going to be published, according to our rough schedule here, in mid-October as we sit here and record it. So that gives us a few minutes to get our act together and get it posted.
How's that website going, Chris?
Yeah, I'm working on it. Still working on that. I'll add it to the list, but I think it's worth getting out sooner than later and get some comments on it. We'll see what we get. Okay. All right, cool. If you're interested in this discussion or taking a look at an early draft of this, let us know. Hopefully by the time this airs, we'll have it posted, but maybe not. So if you don't see a link to it, let us know. We'll send you over a current draft, and we know you're interested in commenting on it. We'd really like to get your feedback. If you've got hot topics or other questions, or we mentioned CDF a number of times, and you really don't know what that is, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can leave us a voice message there through a SpeakPipe widget, or you can leave us a written comment. You can find Chris and I and the other hosts of the show over on LinkedIn or on our about pages on Ascendo Reliability. But we do really look forward to hearing from you and getting your questions. So with that, Chris, I guess we'll go back to writing impossible bodies of knowledges.
Yep. All right. Absolutely.
All right. Talk to you later, Chris.
Cheers, Fred. Have a good one.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.